If it's possible,
is the phone working?
Yeah.
Oh, no, it's not.
It's a recording.
It's a recording.
It's a recording.
Oh, really?
We are video recorded as well?
Yes.
Wow, but like back in Hollywood. Good. So I wanna start thanking the organizer for giving me this opportunity to be here today. Actually, it's the first time that I'm in Waterloo where the temperature is above freezing. That is kind of neat, right? It's an entirely new experience, I gotta say. So today I'm gonna talk about this thing here. So unitary equilibrations, and the subtitle sounds like temporal and Hilbert space typicality of Loschmidt tape. So this is not going to be a review talk about the big picture. This is going to be a talk about a couple of little projects that most of the results I'm going to show, but not all of them, are included in this couple of papers that I and my collaborator Lorenzo Campos Venuti worked out. And we are addressing the equilibration of a closed quantum system, so that is evolving unitarily. And actually, we're not even addressing or even trying to tackle the big problem of equilibration, but we're just observing and trying to understand what can be learned just looking at a specific quantity. And this quantity here is named the Loschmidt echo. I will introduce precisely the notion in a bit. So let's introduce the main character of this talk. Unsurprisingly, the first one is Mr. Loschmidt himself, so an old bearded gentleman speaking Deutsch. We got one more of these gentlemen, and I guess you all know this guy here. There is a picture that is a little younger than the usual one we see. So this, of course, is Ludwig Boltzmann. Okay, so how about the next one?
Von Neumann.
Janosch von Neumann, or also known in USA as Johnny. Okay? Well, so these are somehow the three people that historically have been. I'm sorry?
Oh, no. I said, why don't we see a picture of you?
You will see it later. Okay? They're very cool pictures, but after the last slide. Okay. So, well, what is the problem here? So the problem we are trying to address is whether a closed quantum system with a unitary evolution is in some sense, and the point here is to try to understand in which sense, may display some emergent thermal behavior, or how it comes the closed quantum system that we believe are described by a single individual quantum pure state are eventually, at least as far as a lot of macroscopic observations are describable in terms of density matrix. Yet another point is whether this density matrix is going to be a thermal one. We're not going to address this one here. But we want to try to understand how it comes that this is sometimes possible. In order to study this, we picked a particular observable. It's not defined yet. But let me start with the problem. So you may think, okay, so here is an impossible thought. We all know that given a unitarily evolving system, there's no chance that the system is this long time limit is going to converge to something. Or if you wish, the only possibility that you have an attractive long time point for a unitarily evolution system, that you start from the scratch from a fixed point. So in other terms, the only fixed points of unitary evolutions are eigenspaces. Okay, so this is certainly not the kind of thermal the convergence to equilibrium we are looking for. So we got to look for something different here. Actually, most of my talk is going to be about finite size. I got a bunch of finite dimensional systems, say a spin system there. And if this is the case, so if your Hilbert space dimensionality is going to be finite, well, you see there's another problem here. That of course, your Hamiltonian spectrum is going to be a purely point spectrum. And, well, if you look at any whatever observable quantity, say the time-dependent expectation value of the quantum observable, this quantity here, this function of time, is going to be a quasi-periodic function of time. So this means that there's no way, again, you get the t equal infinity limit, because you get a you're going to have a pattern of non-trivial returns or revivals or eventually even Poincaré or quantum Poincaré recurrences. So it's not converging. So not even a weaker notion of convergence you may have looked at, namely some weak sort of convergence. You don't look at the state. You don't look at the norm convergence in the state space. You just look some observable, and you may think that some of, or some finite a set of relevant observable, they may converge. This is not going to be the case, okay, for finite dimensions. So whatever is your time-dependent expectation value, this is going to be a sum over a finite set of frequencies. So whatever is the accuracy, epsilon, if you wait long enough, depending on epsilon, depending on your Hilbert space dimension T, your quantity here is going to get arbitrarily close to its initial value. And again, this is not what we mean by it. It's certainly something that it's in contrast with the usual notion one may be looking for equilibration, right? So if unitary equilibration exists at all, they have to be different from this, okay? So my talk is going to be about how to make sense of this different sense of equilibration, of convergence, if you wish, looking at a particular quantity. So now is about time I introduce this quantity here. And this is the Loschmidt echo. So the Loschmidt echo is a very natural quantity, I would say. It's basically you start from some initial quantum state, capital Psi, you evolve with some Hamiltonian, and then you take the square of the amplitude of the overlap with the initial state itself. So this is a quantity that certainly starts out of 1 when t is equal to 0, and then has some well-defined time pattern. And this is what we are going to study. So actually, if you expand your initial state in terms of the eigenbasis of the evolving Hamiltonian, the initial state, for the sake of concreteness, may be taken itself as a ground state of a different Hamiltonian. Otherwise, we would have just the fixed time evolution we described before. So you can express in this way. So it's basically the square amplitude of some a characteristic function, and there's actually the characteristic function of the probability distribution of your initial state over the eigenbasis of the evolving Hamiltonian. So this is the expression. This is the spectral resolution of this guy here. Now I wrote the expression for a non-degenerate case. Each of the spectral projections are going to be one-dimensional. This is not strictly necessary for what follows, but is a useful assumption to start with. Okay, so let me go back 1 second. Okay, this is Mr. Loschmidt, sir. So let's have a look to the typical time pattern of this guy here. Okay, so as promised, and it's obvious, we start out of 1. Then somehow you drop down here. This is a zoom of this bigger picture here. This is the time axis. This is the Loschmidt echo axis. You start out of 1 on a short, actually, how short or long this time scale is going to be is a hard problem per se that I'm not going to touch upon in this talk, though in the papers I mentioned there are some little results about that. Then what it does, it drops down to this typical small values. Well, how small is this value and how typical is going to be the focus of this talk. And what you see is this erratic behavior when it's sort of fluctuating with small fluctuations. Again, how small are they? How typically small are they? This is the question. And then something like that. And then, you know, if you wait long enough, we wait long enough, it means typically something of the order of the system size in appropriate time units. You see what I call as revivals. There are spikes. So the guy sort of started out of here, then somehow information or the overlap with the initial state is almost zero. The state gets almost orthogonal. And open boundary condition. This is okay. Thanks, Frank. So this particular plot here is an Ising chain with boundary condition with 100. Okay, it was here. With 100. I think it's open. I think it's boundary, but don't. It's an integrable model. Absolutely. It's mapped into a free fermionic system that they do the old way, like solving, you know, the ground state. And yet I'll show maybe if I have time enough, I'll show a specific result for this system, though most of my talk maybe is going to stay on the rather abstract side. Yes?
If you look at the propagation velocity and the system size, where just look at the time where the excitation propagates to the end and comes back and sees itself again, where would that lie on this diagram?
So really, the real recurrence, when you really expect the t equal 1? Well,
not the full recurrence, kind of the Lee Robinson recurrence, where the sequence sees itself again.
Well, I'm not sure I totally understand. You don't call these revivals? Aren't these revivals these guys? Anyway, are they? So this guy here, so you have a bunch of frequencies we have seen. Somehow you can partition them into different lots that have a characteristic energy scale, say, related to single particle excitation, two particles excitation, and so on. Each of these guys gets rephased after a suitable time. So, for example, this, I think, the rephasing of the single particle excitation you have in your evolving state is responsible for these guys here. And so you see something that is order of L, but you have other revivals order of L squared, L cubed, and eventually the whole thing is going to be probably exponential in the Hilbert space dimension, right? So this is the upper bound of this is the Poincaré thing. Okay, is this answering your question?
Yeah.
Not really. Okay, almost exactly. Almost exactly.
Starting
state here, starting state. This is specific simulation. Well, this is a good point, and I'm going to tell you. This is exactly so. I'm the transverse Ising model, so it's parameterized by the external magnetic field along the x direction. I'm starting out of a ground state corresponding to some H1, actually, you see? So you see a couple of labels here, H1 and H2. H1 stands for the Hamiltonian, that the initial state is a ground state of, while H2 is telling you about the evolving Hamiltonian. So I'm doing what is called as a quantum quench, right? I start out of a ground state of Hamiltonian. I suddenly switch on some magnetic field or some control parameter, and I'm evolving with the Hamiltonian corresponding to this new set of parameters, okay? So this is the ground state of the Ising transverse field model, which H1, given by this value here, and I'm evolving with H2 given by this. But it's not really important here. I just wanted to give you a flavor of the structure of the time-dependent signal I'm looking at looks like. Okay? You happy?
Below the critical point, and then you're questioning about it? Or?
Yeah. No, I'm still below, right? Because the critical point is H equal 1.
Yeah.
You'll see, actually, criticality and the relation with criticality is one of the key points here, even though I'm not quite sure whether we'll get up there, but we can certainly discuss about it. Okay, so you see here that a few features of this signal, of this time series, if you wish, that are interesting. Well, they look, we may have questions to ask. And, of course, the really hard ones are those related to the time scales. So if we call this characteristic time where the signal drops from 1 to this mean value, actually here L bar denotes the long time average of the signal here. So you have the relaxation time here, or something that you may want to call the relaxation time. This is a problem. How this relaxation time depends on the initial state, on the Hamiltonian parameter, on the system size. Then you got the Jens' question, the revival times, how do these guys depend on the same parameter? And when it comes to the statistical features of this signal, what we want to ask is how the mean value, L average, depends on the initial state, on the Hamiltonian parameters, and on the system size. And actually, there's another question, whenever you have a time-dependent signal, then I'm going to think about it as a random variable over the time axis. You want to ask what is the typical amplitude of these fluctuations, or more than typical, if you want to ask a harder question, how these, again, depend on all the parameters defining your problem, right? What is nice about the Loesch-Mitteko that just depends on the initial state and on the Hamiltonian, okay? Somehow it's a global quantity, and the aim here is to try to extract as much information as possible just out of the global features, of the global statistical features of L of T seen as a random variable over the time axis and depending on initial state preparation, okay? So this is the goal. Let me go back, basically. Okay, so basically, these are the set of questions we'll try to address, or we tried to address in the papers. I guess that most of my talk is going to be about this second part here, okay? So if you want to ask questions about time scales, we may do that over a coffee break or a lunch break or whatever break. Okay? Let's go on. Okay, so as I said, so the setting of this problem here I want to play with is the following. So for an initial given preparation, the state psi start out, the Loschmidt echo is a random variable over the timeline, say from 0 to plus infinity. And the probability measure, or the measure that I'm going to put, so in order to have a random variable, you want to have a probability space with a probability measure, and then a random variable is just a measurable function defined over this space. So my probability space, given the state psi, is going to be the whole real axis, or from 0 to infinity. This is going to be the measure. So this is the infinite time average. This is a sort of extreme measure. It just taking this one here makes almost, well, makes impossible or ill-posed whatever question about time scales. Because, guys, this measure here really is a very extreme in the sense it's sort of really spiritual kind of measure. Because, you know, any finite lapse of time, even billions of years, it doesn't matter. Okay, just eternity does. Okay, so all the things I'm going to, well, this is what it does, right? It kills whatever finite fraction of the real time. So whatever question about the time scales is, as I said, ill-posed in this context here, in the game I want to play with you today, okay? So, well, this is my object. This is the probability distribution of the Loschmidt echo, and, of course, it's given by this quantity here, okay? And, well, this is just the time average of this. So I want to ask questions about with which probability I'm going to find the Loschmidt echo, say, a value y. This is going to be a probability density, or with which probability the Loschmidt echo observed over the eternity is going to be within some range. Okay? Good. So the goal, as I said, is to study P of y to extract global information about the equilibration process. Okay? In principle, now I'm going to be sketchy. You would like to have, so remember that I said, okay, there's no norm convergence. No way is unitary. There's no weak convergence as long as you keep the finite dimensionality, as long as you keep your system finite dimensional. Of course, if you make your system infinite dimensional, things are different, right? Because now you have a quasi or a continuous spectrum. Now if you look at observables, they may well have long time limits, right? And you may have a full bunch of observables doing that. Example, the local observable or some subsystem. And as we all know, we can have non-unitary evolution with non-trivial attractive fixed point as long as you couple a finite dimensional system or a system with an infinite dimensional buff, right? Here, this is not a concern. I'm really looking forward to understanding the properties of closed quantum system that is just unitarily evolving. Okay? So the sort of result inspired by the old ideas of Boltzmann and others is this sort of result, morally. Don't take it too seriously. Okay, we got epsilons and deltas, but it's not like the sort of claim that Jens would make. Okay, it's really sketchy here. But the idea is that can we make sense of a convergence in the following sense, that when we take our system size large enough, the probability, namely the measure of the fraction of times where your Loschmidt echo, your time series, is far apart from its expectation value, is greater than epsilon goes to zero. So in more mundane jargon, this sort of measure convergence for this sequence of random variables would mean that if your system is large enough, you know, but most of the times, and we want to give an estimate of how big is this fraction of time, your signal is going to stick very close to its expectation value, right? And actually, I want to have bounds on this, on the dimension of this, of the measure of this set of exceptional times, you see? So the signal, keep in mind the picture I showed you, it drops down, stays very close from time to time, little tiny spikes where it fluctuates away from the ground state, from the mean value. Okay, can we put a bound on those excursions out into exceptional state? Can we make some typicality claim, saying that for most of the times, and possibly, and this is the other key question, for most of the initial preparation, your system is going to stay very close to the mean value. And in this sense, if this mean value turns out to be describable in terms of a density matrix, to make sense of this notion that even a closed quantum system describes an individual quantum state still is effectively describable by a density matrix. We will leave open
the question whether this density metric is a thermal nature or not. Okay, this is yet another question that I'm not going to address. So is this setup kind of clear? I assume so. Okay, so if you want to study probability distribution, of course, the thing you got to do is to study the moments, or at least one possibility is to do so. So first, you want to characterize your probability distribution in terms of the nth moments, right, that, of course, are given by this expression here. And in particular, very important moment, not surprisingly, is going to be the first moment, namely the mean. So that little value, my signal seems to stay close all the times, or most of the times, right? So if you do this, this is a nice calculation, a little tiny back-of-the-envelope sort of calculation, and you see, well, for finite system, works in this way, and you just pick up basically the projection over the spectral. You just pick up basically the time. What I'm trying to say is the time average density matrix, okay, is going to be just the totally dephased matrix by the Hamiltonian. So the mean of the Loesch-Mittekel is going to be the trace of the square of this operator here, something that since this operator here is going to be a density matrix here, a density matrix, actually the dephased density matrix. I'm going to tell you about it in a second. Square, so this is the purity. This is what in quantum information theory we call the purity of the totally dephased density matrix. Okay, so already the first moment seems to have a very nice physical interpretation of that. So what the...
An N?
Is the K on the upper is absolutely N.
Okay.
Yes. It's good. So you're following.
No. Yes.
Absolutely.
Right.
Okay, good. Thanks a lot. It's an N. Okay. This is the moment. So this is the time average density matrix. This guy here exists in a very general way. Okay, you don't have to go to finite dimensional. This is just one version, I guess, of the von Neumann-Ergodic theorem.
And the result is this guy here. Is a CP map, a completely positive map in the quantum information theory jargon, that is basically the complete measurement of the Hamiltonian. Okay? So these are just the spectral projections of the Hamiltonian, and this is the guy. This is the super operator D1 that I define. I put it 1 here because later on, of course, you're going to have a bunch of DNs for each possible moment. You will have the corresponding dephasing super operator. Okay? So this is the purity, and, well, okay, does it make sense? Yes, it does. Frank.
Take the thermodynamic limit of your system?
I believe so, because, as I said, this is just an instance of the von Neumann-Ergodic theorem that holds for, let's put it this way, it holds for a strongly continuous group of isometry over a Banach space. So, yes. Do you disagree?
No, but I mean the theorem, of course, the theorem, but then would you need to approximate this quite well? Of course,
No. Okay, this is yet another question. I guess Frank was asking whether it exists. Was it in the question?
Yeah. But the limits, how do you take the limits?
Oh, well, this is a cute question. I will have something for you later on. It does depend, of course. The order of the limits, it does matter. Okay?
Yes.
Absolutely. Okay, along the lines. Yeah. Yes, real quick sketch. Okay, good. Okay, so D1 is just this projection on the algebra of fixed points of the Heisenberg time evolution generated by H. So you're just taking the invariant part of the evolution. No surprise here. So the question here is, how about the other moments? So, for example, the variance, and how this moment depends on the initial state, because whether are there typical values of that. Because what we have to understand, now we have a random variable that, strictly speaking, is a random variable over the timeline, but it depends on the initial state. So if you wish, it's a joint random variable over t and over the initial state preparation. And the initial state preparation is a pure quantum state, so it lives in the projective Hilbert space that is naturally endowed with a probability measure, namely the unitarily invariant Haar measure, right? So whenever you take your average over time, saying for computing one of these moments here that are characterizing my probability distribution, this is still a function, it's still a random variable of the initial state preparation. So if you wish, py is a distribution value random variable over the set of initial preparations, right? So once you could do the time average, you're still at the question how all these dice, all the different moments, they depend on the preparation. And here, where the second sort of typicality comes in, right? So whether there are typical values as a function of the initial state preparation, as opposed to typical value along the time axis, okay? These are linked, yet different questions. And now I'm going to address them separately somehow. So each moment is a random variable over the unit sphere endowed with the hour measure, okay? Let's have a look at this guy's here. Okay, so Kn can be reshaped in the following form. That is kind of, well, it's kind of nice, especially when it comes to, you know, to taking averages over the hour measure. It's just, well, it's here you have a tensor product of 2n copies of this guy here. This dn is just the n-fold, n-tensor version of d1. So now you are ever, this is a super operator that is the time average over n independent copies, replicas of your Hamiltonian. And is again doing the same job that B1 was used to, was just projecting down to the invariant part. Now it's the invariant part of the dynamics of this n different copies in the Hamiltonian, right? So, well, you can do that, and you can sort of switching the action of the super operator over this S here. S is just a swap. There's a permutation operator between these two different n times copy of the Hilbert space, n times copy here. You can permute this guy here, and you have a swap operator. This doesn't matter if you don't get it. This is a sort of standard tricks that we use in quantum information to compute this sort of things. What is important is once you write this guy here in this way, then it gets really easy, or sort of easy, to compute the average over the initial state preparation, because this is the time. I have something depends on the state. I want to say what is the typical value, what is the average value over the entire Hilbert space, and whether this average value is representative, whether we have some sort of typicality, whether it happens that for most of the states, this average value is a representative. So for most of the states, they take values that are close to that. Okay, so you can perform this average here. As I said, this is a sort of by now well-known tricks in that community, at least. Actually, it was known by von Neumann in the 27. Okay, very same thing. Not surprisingly, there's nothing that they learned here that von Neumann didn't know, I have to say. As you may have noticed, this paper that recently von Neumann posted on the archive. Have you seen that? It's a remarkable paper that, which to me seems to contain most of the things that people published in the last few years in a bunch of PRLs, Nature, and stuff. And this Jan Noschmann, it was 26, basically got almost all this. Okay, but well. Okay, we do this, and let's just look at the result. This is an important part of it. So if you perform this average here, it turns out that when you average this tensor power of states, you get just a projection into the totally symmetric subspace. So you get some formula you can work on. And then at the end of the day, what you find, the first moment, the mean of the Loschmidt table, once it's averaged over all initial state, gets this value here, where little d is the dimension of the Hilbert space. So the message is that if you assume that the Hamiltonian is not degenerate, I could see the eyes of Jens, okay. If it's not, as long as you know that your degeneracy is not comparable with the Hilbert space dimension, you get something that is of the same order, right? But of course, if you have a totally degenerate Hamiltonian, say the unit operator or the zero Hamiltonian, well, of course, you get a different result. You get one. Okay, so this mean of the Loschmidt table is going to be exponentially smaller in the Hilbert space dimension. Okay. I'm sorry. It's going to be 1 over the Hilbert space dimension, so exponentially small in the system size. If you think about your system, as we all do, and we always do in terms of a composite system where we have many copies of local systems. So if you have n spin,
your guy here is going to be 2 to the n, and so you know that your average, the average of the average of the Loesch-Niteko is going to be exponentially small. And this is great news. We can already bound fluctuations, right? Because the Loesch-Niteko, the way it's defined, is a positive value random variable. And if you have a positive value random variable and you know that this average, its mean, its first moment is going to be small, of course you do have a bounds on fluctuations, because of course, you know, fluctuations below the average are squeezed between this average and the x-axis, and so not even the fluctuations above can be really big. So actually, in a more technical jargon, using the Markov inequality, so that one of the elementary inequality that you have in probability theory, you can say that since this guy here is exponentially small in the system size, plus the positivity, we can say that for most of the states in the Hilbert space, so there's the volume of states, basically, you have that most of the states are exponential, they have a value of the mean, the corresponding Loesch-Niteko mean, that is exponentially close to this guy here. Or where by most of the states, I mean there's a subset of volume that is increasingly exponentially getting close to one, whose value is very close to this. So it's safe to assume, as long as you are not looking for exceptional situation, that you may well be willing to do so. But as long as you are just interested in typical behavior, the vast majority, the overwhelming majority of your initial state preparation would give rise to a mean, to a Loesch-Niteko mean that is exponentially small in the Hilbert space. In the exponentially small in the system size. I'm sorry about that. Okay? So here, okay, one couple of remarks. Well, as I said, you have some degeneracy. You have a slightly different formula that doesn't really change much unless your degeneracy are exponential or comparable with the Hilbert space dimension itself. You can get more than this. Of course, then in the audience, I guess I do have at least a few people that are familiar with this measure concentration phenomena. And you may wonder whether you can get more than that, so more than exponential in the system size, whether you can get a concentration phenomenon that is going to be exponential in the Hilbert space, as I keep saying, right, mistakenly. Well, you can do that. You can show that each of these moments of the probability distribution of the Loesch-Niteko is a Lipschitz function over the projective Hilbert space. And so once you know this, by using the Levy lemma, you can prove that indeed this concentration, this state space typicality is going to be exponential, is going to be exponential in the Hilbert space dimensions. Okay? So the concentration is really strong.
So that's concentration with respect to the Haar measure, the unitary invariant measure. Could you think of similar things that would kind of grasp of natural initial conditions, like having random matrix product states as initial states, for example, that would capture the...
Yeah, let's keep it for the coffee break. The answer, the short answer is yes.
Can I'm sorry, I'm totally lost, so...
You're totally lost, no, it's bad. So you blame the speaker. This is what you're going to do, right?
No. So you're considering, for example, some typical non-integrable finite quantum system.
Well, here is very general, right? There's no assumption about integrability.
But it's a lattice model.
It's a lattice model, that's
right. Is it finite size? So you're keeping n fixed and then taking the long time limit?
I'm doing that.
Okay, and where are you going? What are you trying to show?
I'm trying to show in which sense you have equilibration, okay? What I'm trying to show is the other thing that was at the beginning, right? That when the system is large enough, you don't converge to anything, right? But most of the time, you stay very close to something that turns out to be this totally the phase state. So the time average density matrix provides for an exceptionally small set of time observation, captures all the expectation values of the quantum quantity you're looking
at. So when you go back one slide, you have this quantity. I'm sorry, sorry for the elementary questions, but I think just want to clarify.
You
one more.
No, sorry.
The other way.
Whoops, is this one you like?
No, next.
You don't like?
So you have this D1, okay.
D1.
Is that just the diagonal matrix elements of the density matrix? What do you mean by D1?
By D1 I mean what is written here, right?
So I don't understand.
Oh, you don't understand.
No, I don't. Okay. What are you?
So,
I've got some description.
You can say that. If it's non-degenerate, these are just the diagonal parts. Because all the up diagonals are killed when you take the time
average.
So the
more D2 and D3 when you have replicas, you
they are the same thing. But
diagonal matrix on the row to the end. Is that what it is?
No, they are the, almost there. They are the diagonal matrices, but diagonal with respect to the Hamiltonian, which is just the sum of n independent copies of your initial Hamiltonians. Well, maybe we can.
So, is there a context, an experimental setting where this is this kind of question arises, either in terms of a paradox or something? Like, is there, for example, if you have
so you're wondering whether the Lushmann take was a direct operation?
Well, imagine if I have a sufficiently small quantum system and the measurement is done over a time scale which is less than T2. Less than T2. This is an NMR language.
I see. Okay.
That maybe this is observable?
Yeah, I think, well, in principle, you know, the Lushmann take, do you have a chalk? Yeah. Well, the Lushmann take is... So the Lushmann take is the time expectation value of an observable. So if you assume, as we usually do, that whatever observable is measurable, so in a pretty abstract it is. Okay. You want it, and actually I could even devise even more fancy ways of directly measuring L of T, or maybe even just measuring the mean.
Whatever.
Okay. But let me give you a motivation for this. So I think it's mostly, at least in my eyes, is mostly theoretical tools. This is nice because it doesn't depend on any observable. It looks like a quantity. It looks sort of the minimal quantity you can build up in terms of the initial state plus the Hamiltonian. It's pure in this sense, okay? But you may say, okay, I don't really care about this as long as it's not directly measurable. So what I really care of are observables, possibly the local observables, right? So then you can use a theorem that say, okay, you have AT is just my time dependent. This is the Eisenberg evolution of this guy here. Okay, this is something that you measure in experiment, where A is your favorite observable, right? So, well, if you do this, if you take the variance over the timeline of this guy here, so let me denote by this. This is the time average, and I'm running out of chalk here. Nice. You do the variance of this guy here. So this is the variance of time dependent. You can prove under reasonable assumptions that this guy here is bounded by, say, something like this. Don't take it super seriously, but it's morally like this. Okay? This is the operator norm of this. Thanks. Okay. And here, you actually have this guy here. So, because this is the purity of the totally the phase state. So as long as you can make claim about, wow. Well, as long as you can make claim about the smallness of this dude, of this guy here, okay, you know for sure that even the time variance of your time-dependent signal is going to be bounded. So if you wish, there's no direct or no simple... well, this is one-tenth of my talk. But anyway, there's no simple way to measure it, but you may make connection to things that are very meaningful from the experimental point of view. Right. I'm sorry?
Loschmidt introduced this.
Loschmidt, I think it was dead for 150 years before it was actually introduced. I think it's just named after him, right? Well, this is the fidelity, a weak quantum information guy. We like this fidelity thing, right? I think Loschmidt, there was this famous fight, even hotter and more heated than the fight we have here, or we're going to have here, I'm sure. Okay, but, you know, now I'm the guy with the stick, so, well, okay. So Loschmidt, you know, it was this controversy about the statistical approach to gas theory advocated by Boltzmann. He said, okay, it can't possibly be that you converge to anything. We are still dealing with this problem. How can you converge to equilibrium if your underlying dynamics is either Hamiltonian or unitary? As Subir said, what you're trying to show is not going to converge anywhere, this guy here. So we're trying to make sense of this, right? Because we do observe out there this sort of behavior, and we do have to understand that Loschmidt told Ludwig, you know what, this is bullshit.
because, you know, whatever you converge, your h function is not going to go monotonically to zero. How about you reverse all the velocities of your system? And there's no way. If you do that, you know, the Hamiltonian equation will take you all the way back. And so there's no such a thing as a monotonic behavior, right? So I think this is why it's named after that. Because what you do is sort of, well, is a slightly different version. You kick your quantum state, and you're sort of looking the overlap with the initial one, right? So when this guy gets back to one in one of those recurrences, that will be exactly this Loesch-Mittapel getting all the way back, sort of, you know, invalidating this convergence to equilibrium. So, well, I think, yeah, but I think has been named this by people in quantum chaos. But there might be people here knowing more, but. Well, there were in 10 or 15 slides. But let's do this. Okay, so maybe I'll do the Jens thing. I will do for where the epsilon and stuff. So maybe this is like what, in principle, I would like to show. And there are much more stuff that we can discuss in the next week or so, right? Isn't about having discussions here. So, well, now you can compute the variance, and if you do the standard assumption in the field that your Hamiltonian is not just non-degenerate, but even the gaps are non-degenerate, you can prove this bound in terms of the time variance of the Loesch-Mittapel, and you have this upper bound here where K1, again, is this thing, is the mean that I've shown is going to be typically exponentially small. So even the time fluctuations are bounded, and they're bounded by something that is exponentially small in the system size to begin with, and possibly with stronger assumption in the Hilbert space dimension as well. So now you see what, in a way, I wanted to show. Well, one of the things I wanted to show today is, like, you can use the Chebyshev inequality, again, a standard tool in probability theory. And now you can say that a fraction of times where this guy here, L of t, is greater than, is away from its average more than m times sigma, is going to be bounded by m over m to the minus 2. So this means if typically this sigma here can be made exponentially small, you can make this guy here exponentially large, still in a way that this guy here is a very small quantity. So you are bounding whatever small fluctuation by something that is going to be exponentially small. Okay, so the probability that you observe something that is off even of a tiny exponentially small amount from its typical, from the average value is going to be very small, at least for those typical states that having a K1 exponential small. But on the other hand, we argue that those states are really typical. So the fraction of the Hilbert space volume of those is getting exponentially close to 1. Okay? So most of the times, even though globally the system certainly doesn't have any equilibrium fixed points, it behaves as if just eternity matters. It's everything described by just the time averaged or the phase density matrix that I described before, at least in terms of the Loesch-Mittapel. So if you wish, this is the words for this. In the overwhelming majority of time instants, L of t is exponentially close to its equilibrium value, this guy here, okay, over time. But then we know that most of these average over times are themselves very concentrated random variable when it comes to the initial state dependence, right? So you can sort of say that for whatever epsilon and delta, if you pick your system size large enough, you have the probability that you fluctuate away from 1 over d or 2 over d is going to be arbitrarily small as long as you pick your initial preparation in a set of subsets with the system size whose size is going to fill the whole Hilbert space, right? So you may be very unlucky to pick one state where this typicality is violated, but you still may well do so. And actually, this would have been the topic of the next. So moving away from this reassuring, a little boring word of typicality, and to see when you look for exceptional states. For example, when you start from the ground state of one Hamiltonian, and you do a small quench, right? This was pretty much the picture of the Ising chain I started with. You, right now, of course, the system is not very typical, because if you just slightly change the Hamiltonian, your ground state, the initial ground state, is going to be tiny components in all the excited states of the evolving Hamiltonian but the first one. So its purity is going to be close to 1 But the purity is going to be the mean Loschmidt echo. So we're going to have a Loschmidt echo that is going to stay very close to one. Okay? So this is a very, as we argue, this is a super untypical situation. Can we learn something about that? Is there any information that these fluctuations now close to one bring about, for example, criticality of my system or the relation between the initial state and the final Hamiltonian? This would have been the question for the remaining 5 seconds. No, four.
Oh,
is that, well, maybe I can show. Is that Emma? I'm beyond time. It's a great notion. So let's close with Ludwig in our time. You really had the very same argument in the line of attack of the problem about temporal typicality. It was aware, you know, unless you know you make very strong assumptions about your initial state, some this, well, there's a Deutsch word for this that I don't remember, this molecular chaos, you know, you can't really prove that you have a monotonic behavior or whatever dynamical observable like the H functions. But what would happen is that the system would really spend most of its time close to this. And so for all practical purposes, one may argue this equilibrium effective density matrix description is going to be good. Okay? In this talk, we just argue about the Loschmidt echo. Though I think I'll stop it here and just maybe show the next. Well, okay, this was for Jens. Was another thing, but yeah. You can do better. You can do exponential in the Hilbert space dimension if you just assume, you know, ergodic motion over the torus and the usual thing, you know. You have the usual exponential concentration in the space. And, well, if you don't stop me, I keep going. okay. Okay, I'll get the stick.
Maybe it'll be a slide.